industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
I'd like to introduce Dr. Veronica Groff. She went to medical school at Vanderbilt University and then completed residency in emergency medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. She is currently a second-year fellow in medical toxicology at the University of Arizona, Phoenix.
Thanks, Adam. I'll be talking about Dr. Langston and the frozen addicts. And this is a story about how a catastrophic mistake in the designer drug world led to a major scientific breakthrough in the study of Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's is the second most common neurodegenerative disease behind Alzheimer's, affecting over 6 million people globally. It is a disorder primarily of movement, characterized by the loss of dopamine-producing neurons in the substantia nigra. Without the ability to produce dopamine, the affected individual has difficulty initiating movement. This manifests clinically as bradykinesia, tremor, and rigidity. Despite its prevalence and millions of dollars and hours of research, both its cause and an effective cure remain elusive. The primary treatment, developed in the 1960s, is to administer a precursor of dopamine, levodopa. Levodopa is able to cross the blood-brain barrier and once in the brain is converted to dopamine. While this allows patients to regain their ability to move, it comes with several side effects that often limit its use. Because animals do not get neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, research into new therapies for the treatment of Parkinson's disease was stunted for many years without an effective animal model in which to trial new therapies. On July 16th of 1982, neurologist Dr. J. William Langston was called by his fellow, Dr. Phil Ballard, to examine a puzzling new patient who had been admitted to the Santa Clara Valley Medical Center in San Jose, California. The patient was George Carrillo, a 42-year-old man who had been admitted to the psychiatric unit from jail. Just 16 days before, George had been a normal, healthy person. Then one night, he was using heroin with his girlfriend, and as he injected it, he had an unusual burning sensation. The next morning, he awoke with severe and rapidly progressing stiffness. He presented to the courthouse later that day for a parole hearing, where his shuffling gait was mistaken for PCP intoxication, and he was subsequently jailed for violation of his parole. Over the next week in jail, his stiffness continued to worsen to the point that he was entirely unable to move or speak. He was given a preliminary diagnosis of catatonia and admitted to the psychiatry unit. After 2 weeks in the hospital, it became clear that his symptoms could not be attributed to a psychiatric illness, and so he was transferred to the neurobehavioral unit in search of a neurologic explanation of his strange symptoms. When Dr. Langston saw him, he was mute and could not move. He exhibited the classic masked face, cogwheel rigidity, and bradykinesia that is typical of advanced Parkinson's disease. But while his symptoms seemed to be a perfect fit, the history of rapid progression over days in a relatively young patient was not consistent with Parkinson's, which is generally a slowly progressing disorder primarily affecting patients over the age of 50. George was able to communicate only through painstakingly slow writing. In this way, he was eventually able to tell Doctors Langston and Ballard about his heroin use and about Juanita. George would be the first in a cohort of six patients with this new form of early onset, rapidly progressing Parkinsonism. The same mysterious progressive stiffness would soon affect his girlfriend, Juanita Lopez. After George was arrested, she had returned to her family's home where she too had become stiff and frozen. Her family brought her to an emergency department where her symptoms were attributed to PCP intoxication, and she was sent home. Over the next few days, her condition worsened. Afraid she would face legal trouble related to her drug use, her family tried their best to care for her at home on their own. By the time Dr. Langston came calling, she was entirely dependent on her family for changing, bathing, and eating. The next two patients were brothers, David and Bill Silvey. They were drug dealers and had gone on a celebratory binge after a particularly successful week distributing a new batch of heroin. When she hadn't heard from them in several days, their mother went to their home to check on them. She discovered them on the floor of their apartment, unable to move. Like George, they were initially diagnosed with catatonia and were discharged home. However, their primary doctor was dissatisfied with this diagnosis, thinking it odd that two brothers would be stricken with such severe catatonia at exactly the same time. He sent them to see a neurologist, Dr. Jim Tetrod, who recognized their symptoms as those of advanced Parkinson's disease. By chance, that month, Dr. Ballard attended a dinner party hosted by Dr. Tetrad, where the two discussed their puzzling new cases. It became clear at that point that the four cases shared only one exposure in common, the use of IV heroin. Thanks to this chance interaction between Drs. Tetrad and Ballard, the physically debilitating symptoms were traced back to a bad batch of heroin. Dr. Langston, recognizing the potentially catastrophic public health implications of this, was quick to alert the press. Over the next few days, the Santa Clara Valley Medical Center released a statement and held a press conference that was aired on the nightly news across Northern California. The rapid dissemination of information to the public about the potential of a dangerous poison contaminating the heroin supply was key in preventing the tragic fate of these six patients from turning into a catastrophic epidemic of Parkinsonism in young people. It also brought Dr. Langston his next two cases, a young woman named Connie Sains and her boyfriend Toby Govea. Connie had been brought to the hospital by her sister when she rapidly lost the ability to move or speak. Her family reported that this had occurred after she discovered that her recently incarcerated boyfriend had become paralyzed in jail. The physicians treating her concluded that she was afflicted with severe conversion disorder, and she was discharged home with the expectation that her symptoms would gradually improve. She was being cared for by a physical therapist who saw the reports about heroin-related Parkinsonism on the nightly news and alerted Dr. Langston about the potential two new patients. Convinced that these six young patients were suffering from a Parkinson's-like syndrome, Dr. Langston decided to treat them in the same way that he would his other patients with Parkinson's disease. He started each of them on levodopa. The results were almost immediate. Within days, his patients were able to walk, talk, and return home. However, their reprieve from their disease was short-lived. Like most patients treated with levodopa, they all soon began to suffer the severe side effects of the treatment, including hallucinations, paranoia, and freezing episodes. 2 years after starting levodopa, the Silvey brothers had returned to their former life of dealing drugs and petty theft. One day, they had robbed a house, and as what they were fleeing police, one of the brothers suffered a freezing episode. As he climbed a fence to get away, the effects of his medication suddenly switched off, leaving him frozen on the fence and ultimately landing both brothers back in jail. Toby, George, and Connie all developed severe hallucinations within a few years of starting levodopa. And in Connie's case, the paranoid hallucinations eventually became so severe that she had to stop the medication altogether. With six confirmed cases of drug-induced Parkinsonism and potentially hundreds more at risk, Dr. Langston and his colleagues set about attempting to identify how the heroin had caused the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. At the time, synthetic designer drugs were on the rise. Drug dealers were increasingly employing experimental chemistry to produce novel compounds that acted as opioid agonists but could evade detection and enforcement of scheduled substance regulations. Dr. Langston was able to obtain samples of the heroin used by the Silvey brothers and by George and Juanita and send it for testing. The toxicology labs were able to identify that the compound was actually not heroin at all, but rather a new designer drug that was structurally related to the narcotic meperidine. But the exact identity of the toxin still remained a mystery. It wasn't until another chance interaction that progress towards definitive identification of the molecule could be made. A chemist at the San Jose Crime Lab, Haley Weingarten, was assigned to work on identifying the toxic compound for the DEA as part of an investigation into a suspected designer drug operation. Dr. Langston called her regularly to see if the DEA had been able to make any progress towards identifying the compound. One day, she recalled reading a case of a patient who had been stricken with a Parkinson's-like syndrome as a result of injecting homemade meperidine analogs and sent the article to Dr. Langston. As it turned out, the six victims in San Jose were not the first to have met this tragic fate. Barry Kitson was a 23-year-old college student in Bethesda, Maryland, in 1976. He had abused a wide variety of drugs as a teenager while living abroad with his parents. After moving to Bethesda as a young adult, he set out to synthesize his own narcotics, reasoning that it would be easier and cheaper than buying them on the streets. His drug of choice was 1-methyl-4-phenylpropionoxypiperidine, or MPPP. MPPP is similar in structure to meperidine, but approximately 5 times more potent. For months, Barry was able to successfully synthesize MPPP with an old chemistry set that had been gifted to him by his parents. As he grew more confident in the synthesis, he began cutting corners, running the reaction at higher temperatures to decrease the time it took to synthesize. One day, after injecting a new batch, he immediately knew something had gone wrong. The MPPP from this new batch burned in his veins, unlike anything that he had experienced before. Over the next 3 days, he became paralyzed and mute, just as the victims in San Jose would 6 years later. His parents brought him to the hospital, where he too was diagnosed with catatonia, but when conventional treatments for catatonia failed, he was brought to a neurologist who ultimately diagnosed him with severe advanced Parkinson's disease. He was treated with levodopa and benztropine, which produced dramatic reversal of his symptoms. He was then referred to the NIH, where his team of doctors hypothesized that Barry had inadvertently synthesized a powerful neurotoxin, one that was capable of recreating the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Residue from Barry's synthesis was analyzed, which confirmed that Barry had indeed synthesized MPPP, but with two contaminants. 1-methyl-4-hydroxy-4-phenylpiperidine, or MHPP, and 1-methyl-4-phenyl-1,2,3,6-tetrahydropyridine, or MPTP. Suspecting that one of these contaminants was the neurotoxin, the NIH team injected these compounds into mice, but it failed to produce the same Parkinson's-like symptoms in the mice as it had in Barry. Unfortunately, 18 months after the unfortunate mistake that brought about his Parkinsonism, Barry died of a drug overdose. The results of his autopsy were impressive. The cells of the substantia nigra had been almost entirely destroyed. When Dr. Langston read the report of Barry Kitson's illness, he asked his colleagues to compare the mass spectrometry data from the unknown substance in the heroin they had collected to that of MPTP. It was an exact match. In fact, the synthetic heroin was actually 97% MPTP and 3% MPPP. This provided strong evidence that MPTP was the culpable compound, despite the previous negative results in mice. Dr. Langston decided to try injecting MPTP into primates. Within hours, the primates suffered the same effects that the MPTP had produced in his initial 6 patients. The physicians at the NIH conducted their own similar experiments and got similar results. Finally, there was an explanation for what had produced the tragic illness. Over the next decade, several different research groups gradually pieced together the puzzle of how MPTP was able to produce Parkinsonism. Once injected, MPTP is able to cross the blood-brain barrier and is then oxidized by monoamine oxidase B to 1-methyl-4-phenylpyridinium, or MPP plus. MPP plus is then taken up by dopamine reuptake transporters, causing it to accumulate within the dopaminergic neurons of the substantia nigra. In this oxidized state, MPP plus interferes with normal cellular function in a variety of ways, but most notably through inhibition of complex one of the electron transport chain, causing cellular damage that ultimately leads to neuronal cell death. With these dopaminergic neurons destroyed, the patient rapidly develops the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. This discovery that MPTP could produce Parkinsonism in humans and in primate models ushered in a new era of research and funding. Tragically, despite this major breakthrough, the outlook for patients with Parkinson's disease remains bleak. Many new therapies were investigated thanks to the development of a reliable animal model. In fact, three of the original 6 patients from San Jose, George, Juanita, and Connie, received experimental fetal tissue transplants years after their diagnosis. Fetal substantia nigra cells were transplanted into their basal ganglia with the hope that these cells could grow to produce dopamine. While the 3 patients initially seemed to show some improvement, unfortunately, this promising therapy did not produce real lasting results. Today, there are still no disease-modifying therapies, and levodopa, despite its many adverse effects, remains the primary treatment for Parkinson's disease. And that is the story of the frozen addicts.